Mick Clifford, writing in today's edition of the Irish Examiner, has brought us the story that four prison officers are being investigated after three of them went on the beer during the escort of a dangerous gangland criminal to and from court. Mick Clifford joins me on the line now. Mick, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara.
This seems like an extraordinary turn of events. Talk us through it.
Yes, well, as you can imagine, escorts to and from prison to courts are pretty frequent. And often it involves the accompaniment of two prison officers. That would be the case for what you might call ordinary criminals. All that's required really is two prison officers to go along with them in the van. However, in this instance, there were four, a senior officer and three junior officers. Now, that is a system that's put in place when it's considered that the prisoner may be regarded as being somewhat dangerous or defined as such on the prison information system, the PRIS. So this occurred, they were going up to Dublin to the Criminal Courts of Justice building in Dublin there near Houston Station for a sentencing hearing. They went off and they went up to Dublin as per normal from Portlaoise. In Dublin, it would seem that at some stage and in some ways, three of the officers went drinking. The hearing commenced, the hearing finished. At the end of the day, they were due to go back to Portlaoise and it became obvious to the senior officer that the other three are certainly the one who was assigned to drive the van. Now, one of them would have been assigned to drive the van for today, was not in a fit state to do so. So the senior officer came to the conclusion that the senior officer would have to drive the van. Now, that's against the rules, so to speak, because the senior officer is supposed to be overseeing the security of the situation. But in this instance, the officer was driving the van. They got back on the road to Portlaoise down the M7. Then at some point, at least one of the three officers needed to use the bathroom facilities. It would appear this, as people can imagine, the call of nature became quite intense after a feed of beer. So he wanted to stop this officer and was told by the senior officer, no, on the basis that was completely against the rules for security reasons. Under no circumstances outside of security-related matters should you ever stop the vehicle going between the court and the prison, quite understandably so, you know, leaves it open to all sorts of security problems. The discussion continued and apparently got intense, and one report says that at one stage the security officer who wanted to use the facilities threatened that he would would make do with things in the van. But so in any event, a decision was finally arrived to stop at Junction 14 on the M7. Your listeners will know it well, I'm sure. The services stop there south of Kildare Town. There's a lot of facilities there. At that place, the three officers went in to relieve themselves. The senior officer was then cuffed to the prisoner because there was no one else to do so. Now, one of the reports I have is that inside in the services, the three officers used the occasion to indulge in a quick bit of grub, some food.
What?
That's according to one report I had. That while they were waiting, while they'd gone in, they also decided to use the occasion to grab something to eat. It's unclear what exactly they ate or whether they ate inside or brought outside or whatever, but that is certainly one of the reports I have heard. One way or the other, it's indicative that there appears not to have been any urgency about the stop and the fact that they shouldn't have stopped and therefore should get back on the road as quickly as possible. That would appear to be the case. They got back to Portlaoise in one piece. And then what had occurred came out in various ways and management came to the management's attention and this investigation as the whole thing was begun.
I mean, that there's just so much to unpack there. The fact of apparently going drinking on the job, any job, is one thing. Then the senior officer having to drive. Then what seems to be some kind of a row of sorts, although I don't know that it arose to that level, about stopping to use the facilities, then stopping to use facilities, and then apparently grabbing a bite to eat. Would it not have been open to the senior officer, Mick, to give a call back to Portlaoise or to his or her senior officers before they got back in the van to say, I don't know what to do here?
That is exactly, if all the rules were followed, Ciara, what should have been done. And the senior officer is in a bit of trouble because the senior officer did not do that. exactly as you say, in Dublin, once the situation became apparent, senior officer should have contacted Portlaoise and explained the situation. Now, it would appear that the senior officer, who was only recently promoted from what I can gather, did not want to put the three officers in a compromising position or suggest that they had not conducted themselves properly to the extent that was apparent. That is the information I have. But as you say, that would have been open to the senior officer, and one wonders whether the senior officer regrets not doing that.
And at what stage, insofar as you're aware, Mick, does the investigation stand now?
It's ongoing. There's an examination of the CCTV footage from the screening area, which is just inside the entrance to the prison where everybody is searched. As I understand it, there's also efforts to get CCTV footage from the CCJ in Dublin to examine what the story was there in terms of whether the officers conducted themselves appropriately. And there would be interviews as well. The one thing I don't know, and I think it would be interesting, is whether the prisoner was interviewed and what he had observed about the whole matter.
It would seem logical to talk to the prisoner because there were five people in the vehicle. Why speak to four and not the fifth?
Absolutely. No, you have a cultural issue there in terms of if a disciplinary issue arises for a prison officer. Some culturally within the service have issues around the fact that, to put it this way, a prisoner's word might be taken over a prison officer's word. So I just don't know the stats of that or whether that could add to the situation or what value would be put on whatever the prisoner had to say. What is one interesting aspect to it in that regard is that the one officer was left with the prisoner in the van at the Junction 14 services because, like, for example, in a different scenario, if the van had been followed by an associate of the prisoners or anything, you don't know what could have unfolded there. Thankfully, that wasn't the case.
Certainly a remarkable turn of events. Mick Clifford, special correspondent at the Irish Examiner and writing extensively on this story in today's edition of that paper. Thank you indeed for joining us. An absolutely lovely WhatsApp has just come in to us, 0833 97 97 97. Hi, could you wish our two wonderful daughters, Frances Stacey and Louise Sheridan, on giving birth this morning within a couple of hours of one another to Charlie Stacey and Caitlin Sheridan from very proud grandparents Leo and Mary Sully in Clownings in Newbridge. Congratulations, grandparents. Congratulations, new mammies and all of their families. What a happy day in that household. Now, you may remember I spoke to Fianna Fáil Senator Lisa Chambers last week about proposals by the Department of Health to bring in free contraception come budget 2022. And we don't yet quite know the shape of what that's going to look like. Will it be segregated by age? How will that free contraception be made available? I'm joined now on the line by Cathy Marr. She's a community pharmacist and chair of the Irish Pharmacy Union Pharmacy Contractors Committee. Cathy, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
I imagine to ensure 100% that this free contraception scheme proceeds and gets where it needs to go, you want pharmacies at the centre of it.
Absolutely. To see free contraception for women in Ireland would be an extremely progressive development for women of Ireland. But we know by putting pharmacy in the centre of that, we could actually improve its efficiency. By eliminating the requirement for doctors' involvement to allow women access prescriptions, to access their hormonal contraception without prescription, would actually really help free up GP time, but it would also give women so much more choice. Barriers to contraception are not always financial. It is a barrier, but it's not always financial. Non-barriers include the need to get to a doctor, the need to get a prescription, the need to get that repeat to have the blood pressure done. We noticed throughout COVID that when women couldn't access face-to-face appointments with their GP, pharmacists stepped in and we were able to give careful attention to BMI, the body mass index, the blood pressure, and we could have those conversations. We know that this is would be a really successful service. And we know the pill is one of the most widely used forms of contraception. It's safe, it's well studied, and we know it's been used for almost half a century. So we know the pharmacists would be provided with training on the dispensing and prescribing of the oral contraception and would supply the most suitable contraception for that woman. So it's not rocket science. It's really safe and really, really effective. We know it benefit the government, it benefit GPs and free up GP time. And the end user, the woman at the centre of this, will have the best benefit.
So there are kind of two pillars to this contraceptive-related call. One is that it is centred, the administration of free contraceptives is centred within pharmacy settings. But the second is that the pill should be available without prescription. Do you imagine that latter call might be a little bit controversial?
It's not too controversial. It has happened very recently in the UK. Two progestogen-only hormonal contraceptions, oral contraceptions, were made without prescription, were made available without prescription to women in the UK. And many countries around the world already provide their services through pharmacy, such as New Zealand, Australia, many states in the US, and France very recently said that they will start from 2022, allowing women up to the age of 25 access oral contraception from their pharmacists without the need for prescription. These are really safe medicines. Mm. It's a really safe service to do. And ultimately, while we look at free contraception, which would include things like the coil or an implant, as well as oral contraception, we have to think about patient choice. And patient choice very often comes down to the convenience of taking an oral contraceptive. So that's where we have to really see, where can we make this more accessible to women? And the financial barrier is a barrier, but it's not the only barrier. So we want to really improve accessibility. So that entails taking away the need to get the doctor's prescription. These are safe medicines. Pharmacists are the medicines experts. We were open throughout COVID. We were accessible to all of those women and continue to be so. We see a lot of women actually access prescriptions online via online doctors and then come into pharmacies, and they still have the blood pressure check in the pharmacy. We still go through all of the risk factors. So we're doing it de facto anyway, but we know that taking away that element of the prescription will make it much more accessible to all women.
Do you think perhaps the conversation around free contraception has centred too much on the financial barrier, which is a clear and present barrier for a lot of women? But you've pointed out accessibility, timeliness, just the logistics of going hither, thither and yon in order to be able to get the prescription and then get the contraceptive.
There is that, but also we have to look at all of our patients. So our patients may have medical cards, or they may have maybe private prescriptions. For complete equity and accessibility, free contraception for women should be introduced in this year's budget. It is a very progressive development for women in Ireland. It is the current norm in the UK, notwithstanding the fact that they do need a prescription for some medicines. Contraception is free for women in the UK, our nearest neighbours. So absolutely, we look at reducing crisis pregnancies. We look at reducing risk of abortion because crisis pregnancies aren't occurring, and women have that choice around their own sexual health and well-being.
Well, Cathy Maher, Community Pharmacist and Chairperson of the Irish Pharmacy Union's Pharmacy Contractors Committee, thank you indeed for joining us. A report compiled by the Abortion Rights Campaign and Lorraine Grimes has found that half of respondents, 54% in all, did not know where to go to get an abortion. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Helen Stonehouse. She's co-convener of the Abortion Rights Campaign. Helen, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Delighted to do so. Another one of a headline figure from this study said that 32% of respondents did not know where to find information on abortion when they initially went looking. There's an awful lot of people in the dark here.
Yes, and I mean, it's very disappointing, but I suppose with the Abortion Rights Campaign, we're not hugely surprised that there is that lack of information. Sort of after 35 years of abortion being spoken about only in hushed tones and behind closed doors, it's going to take actual significant effort to break down that stigma and make abortion much more of an everyday part of our sexual and reproductive health services. So it's one of the things that we need. We need more and better information about abortion in the public awareness.
Because we have seen quite significant public awareness campaigns on all manner of health services, and their efficacy really seems to be quite high. And yet we do not see anything approaching this when it comes to abortion services. I would imagine in the short term it might be probably unlikely. But clearly, if so many people are finding themselves in a position where they need to access an abortion, don't know how to do it, don't know that abortion care is free under 12 weeks of gestation and thereafter access is limited, that is a huge multi-layered problem.
Absolutely, you're completely right. It's a massive problem. I think in January 2019, when services first came in, I recall seeing a few adverts on buses and so on and so forth. I haven't seen any of those in coming up on 3 years now. I think there was a little bit of effort at the start, and I think there is a huge reluctance from probably the Department of Health and from politicians to really engage with it further. And we do. We need significant information. We also need to really be reaching out into communities that, again, typically struggle to access good healthcare information, whether that's Roma and traveller communities, whether that's migrant communities. And I think this lack of information becomes even more worrying when you consider the prevalence of rogue crisis pregnancy agencies, so that is groups that provide false information to intentionally delay someone from accessing care. This has been an issue for the last 10 years, and successive governments, again, have failed to do anything to regulate that either.
I know a lot of people listening to you and I, Helen, having this conversation are quite naturally saying, well, why don't you ask your GP? Because that, for the vast majority of healthcare services, unless it is an abject emergency, most of us will toddle along to our local GP surgery and say, hello, X, Y and Z. But that belies the fact that there are a not insignificant number of GPs' practices and surgeries across Ireland, and individual doctors who elect not to provide abortion services.
That's absolutely right. I mean, so what are we, 3 years on, and roughly 10% of GPs are providing abortion services, which means that about 90% aren't providing. So in our report, one in five participants were refused abortion care at their GP and also refused referral onto another provider, which is, in legislation, they are GPs are obliged to refer. One participant spoke of calling nine different surgeries before she could get an appointment. I think that what many people do toddle along to their GPs, and quite frankly, they're just told to toddle off again without any information. And that's completely unacceptable. And again, half of our maternity hospitals don't provide either. So it's actually not as easy as you might hope to just walk into your GP surgery and access abortion.
So, and in those cases, I don't know if you have this information, Helen, where women contacted their GP to ask for abortion services, were told no, and then not referred on. Were they given any reason at all? Was it that I don't know of a general practitioner who provides a service, or I don't want to refer you on?
So from the information that we have from people who have been refused care, it is GPs who are choosing not to engage. So it is people who are perhaps against abortion for whatever reason. But in some cases as well, we know that it's not the only reason why GPs might not provide. So, for example, we've heard a lot in the news recently about safe access zones. And there's a number of GPs who are understandably concerned about their patients and their staff and themselves walking through anti-abortion protesters every day on the way to work, and those kind of things will put people off from providing. There are great networks of GPs out there that are doing everything they can to support those who want to provide, but we're still looking at a situation where the vast majority of GPs don't provide.
And the information campaign, Helen, that was mentioned as part of this study, which was co-conducted by yourselves and Lorraine Grimes, what manner and form should that take?
I mean, I think we also just need to, there's lots of things that could come out of this, but we also just need to be talking about the information, the resources that are already there. We do have, and just, oh my gosh, I should have pulled up the phone number in front of me. There is My Options. The HSE does run an abortion information services that you can call and you can get the information for a GP who is providing. But on the other hand, that's quite, if you type abortion in Ireland into the internet, that's not necessarily the first thing that comes up, do you know? So we need to be sharing information about the resources that are already there, as well as, developing more research and finding out what else people need to know.
Well, Helen Stonehouse, co-convener of the Abortion Rights Campaign, thank you indeed for joining us. We could be in for a winter of discontent in terms of how much we're having to pay for gas and electricity. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Dara Cassidy, head of communications at bonkers.ie. Dara, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
In fact, since Kildare Focus came on air at 2 o'clock, we've heard that Bord Gáis is hiking its electricity and gas prices next month. They'll apply to residential customers only. We'll go up on October 24th. Gas is going up by around €8.16 a month for your typical household. The change in electricity prices will mean €10.26 per month on a typical bill. That is a lot of money.
It is. It's a lot, and some of the smaller energy suppliers out there, but who still have tens of thousands of customers between them, have announced price increases that are even bigger. And some of the suppliers have announced price increases that are going to add maybe 700 to 800 euro a year to the average household's energy bills. So it's absolutely insane. I've never seen anything like it. I think, you know, we use the words crisis and unprecedented a lot, but this is what we're seeing at the moment. It is an energy crisis, and it is absolutely unprecedented.
And it does mean that there will be people across Ireland who will be sitting in darkness, who will be cold, who may not be able to make their dinner because they can't afford the bill.
Well, potentially. I mean, I think gas and electricity bills are always a bit of a struggle. You know, at the best of times, I don't think anybody ever gets their gas or electricity bill at the height of winter after Christmas and says, oh, look, was it only, you know, 100 euro? There's usually a gap that we let in. Because energy prices here aren't cheap. We have among the most expensive electricity in the EU, and we have among the most expensive gas. Although gas prices, until recently, were at least a little bit close to the EU average. So, you know, heating homes here isn't cheap. A lot of homes, as I always say in Ireland, they don't have a great energy rating. We've got kind of a cold, damp climate as well. So, you know, we do spend a lot of money on energy in Ireland, and I think this winter, a lot of people, unfortunately, are going to be in for a big shock. And I think a lot of these price increases until recently have probably gone under the radar. It's been summer, we've had a nice September, it's been quite warm, but as you move into the winter months and, you know, we turn on the heating, we turn on the lights, I think people could be in for a big shock when they get that winter bill, which usually comes, you know, from around November onwards.
And there's no real way around it. There's no amount of quick-footed switching from provider to provider that's really going to enable you to escape this.
In some ways, no, as in prices are going up across the board. So there's 14 energy suppliers in the Irish market, which is actually quite a lot. And they've all increased prices since the start of the year, and some have increased prices four times, which, as I said, is unprecedented. A lot of people say, listen, what's the point in switching if they're all increasing prices? But listeners just need to remember that energy companies offer really, really big discounts to new customers. So it's like sometimes when you look for car insurance or you look for maybe a new mobile phone provider, they're always offering the best deals to new customers. So you could get a discount still of around maybe 30 to 40% off the standard rate by switching. So even though, yes, it's a discount off a higher price because prices are going up, at least you are still saving. And at the moment, somebody who switches could save over 500 euro a year. Now, again, it'll be 500 euro off a bigger bill, but at least you are saving. And I think actually more so than ever, it's important that people switch.
And dependent upon your household type, I would imagine, Dara, if you were able to switch and got one of those deals, it might mean that your bill could be on a par with last year or thereabouts.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, particularly if you're on, you know, standard rates and you're paying top dollar, I suppose, and you haven't switched in a while, you can save big money by switching. So as you've said, your bill, if you were to switch, may not actually come in that much bigger than this time last year, which would obviously be a huge comfort for people.
Now, we do have quite a lot of control in most cases over particularly how much electricity we use. And most people just forget that you can reduce your electricity outgoings without having somebody in the corner mumbling, this is not Blackpool Illuminations turning off the lights.
No, you're right. And some of these sound really, really simple. I'll go through them, but I will say that there is lots of information online. So listeners should, you know, have a quick Google to find out energy savings tips. The SEAI, which is the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland, also has some good tips for how to reduce energy consumption without, you know, leaving you in the cold and in the dark. But just simple things like turning on or using LED light bulbs. So they use around 80 to 90% less electricity than a standard light bulb. So changing one would save you around, they say, 6 euro a year. Now, it mightn't seem like a lot, but if you were to change, let's say, 10 light bulbs around the home, you know, you're looking at saving there already, you know, 60 euro. And LED light bulbs tend to last up to 10 times longer than non-LED light bulbs as well. The second thing is overfilling the kettle. So whether you're making a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, boiling water consumes a huge amount of electricity don't think people realise that. You know, I suppose it's like when you step into the electric shower, you think, God, how much am I using? It's the same when you boil the kettle. So if you only want one cup of tea, only put in enough for just over, you know, one cup. Tackling drafts as well is another, you know, key thing for people to do. And then also just unplugging appliances late at night. So laptops, computers, they can guzzle energy. It's called phantom electricity or vampire electricity because it continues to suck out electricity. That can really all add up as well. And if some things like the broadband, okay, you might want to, you know, disconnect it every single night because you'll have to wait for it to reconnect in the morning. But certainly, you know, just look and look at some of those appliances that you see plugged in and think, listen, do they still need to be plugged in while they're not being used?
And they are, as you say, Dara, quite small changes, and they sound almost too small to be bothered with. But all of those, if you made them, if they worked for your house and all of those things needed to be addressed in your home, that's a fair chunk of change off the bill over the course of a year.
No, it is. I mean, if you were to do that, you're looking at maybe, you know, saving another €200 on your bills as well. Another thing as well is just, I would always say to people, mind the cooker. Some of the newest cookers, the A-rated cookers, use very, very little electricity, which is fine. But if you have a cooker that's maybe 5 or 10 years old, per second of usage, it can use sometimes around maybe a third as much energy as a electric shower. Or in other words, if you were to put on the, you know, the oven for an hour, which a lot of people might do if they're cooking a Sunday roast, it's the equivalent of maybe spending 15 or 20 minutes in an electric shower. Now, if I spent, I don't know, 15 or 20 minutes in the electric shower, my dad would have killed me. But I don't think people sometimes just realise the appliances that use energy.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, we're trying to cut back on appliances that don't actually use much energy. But when it comes to things like, let's say, the cooker, you know, we've no problem putting on the cooker. I mean, I'm terrible pulling on the cooker, waiting for it to heat up and then disappearing for 20 or 15 minutes, you know. So again, little things like that can all add up.
Well, Dara Cassidy, Head of Communications at bonkers.ie, thank you indeed for joining us. The European Commission has decided to seek the manufacturers of smartphones to adopt one standard charger for all electronic devices. It's been welcomed as an enormously positive step by consumer groups. But joining me now is tech correspondent Jess Kelly. How are you, Jess?
I'm great.
The first thing I would say about this, Jess, is phone chargers one size for all the best, I guess, avenue to go down at the moment? What about, you know, adapters? When you go to other countries, especially when we're not in the middle of a pandemic, it can be very difficult to remember to bring it, or you might buy your electronic devices from these other countries and unfortunately not able to use it in your own country.
Yeah, I think it's very much focused on the cable side of things. So if, for example, you have an Android device, so be that manufactured by Samsung, by Huawei, even though they're using their own operating system now, Oppo, any of those brands that use the operating system of Android tend to have a USB-C connector on the bottom of the phone. The only real outlier in terms of phones at the moment is iPhone. iPhone use what's called the Lightning Charger port, which is a bit of a pain in the face. If you live with someone who has an Android device, you need to have your own special cable. And I think that's very much where this is focused at the moment. It also takes into consideration things like, you know, a Kindle. If you have an e-reader, at the moment they're still using the older micro USB. So I think what this is trying to do is create a universal charger port that means that you don't need to go out and buy a specific cable, or the manufacturer doesn't need to send you a specific cable. What we've seen in recent years is phone manufacturers are no longer sending the plug bit, because they kind of assume at this stage everybody has a plug that you can put a USB cable into. So it's more about the port on the device itself, rather than the other end that goes into the wall or into your laptop.
Yeah, I know myself, I have a good few of those plugs that any USB cable could fit into. But when it does come to the devices, is it literally everything, Jess? Would it be with, say, our smartwatches, our Kindles, as you mentioned, or any, you know, e-reader, the phones, the iPads? Is it literally everything?
That's what they're looking for. Now, it may not be possible, because you mentioned smartwatches there, for example. Anyone who has, you know, an Apple Watch or a Samsung Watch or a Fitbit will know that it is a specific charger is required because of the nature of how you charge the device. So as I understand it, it is more focused towards laptops, tablets, e-readers, that type of thing.
Now, just go into a bit more detail exactly why Apple aren't happy.
Well, there's a few different reasons. Like, Apple has always been, I suppose, the awkward child in the tech world. They very much wanted to do things their own way. They've wanted to keep their operating system very much locked down. They haven't really wanted to play ball when it comes to opening things up. They are saying that their Lightning charger port is there, it works well, but we have actually seen them make changes. Anyone who has an iPad Pro 2021 or an iPad Air, or indeed the new iPad Mini that was unveiled last week, will know that you can charge those devices with the USB-C, which is the one that's available on the Android phones, as I mentioned earlier on. So they're not completely allergic to the idea, but they just seem to be dragging their heels for some reason. Some people, some skeptical people might say that that's just Apple being Apple. The other thing that we need to acknowledge here, though, as well, is that, you know, with wireless charging, the charger port is not going to be the most imperative thing as technology continues to advance. As phones get better at fast charging wirelessly, you may not even need a charger port on your device in years to come. So although this is getting a bit of attention, and although it is a good conversation to have, and particularly when the motives are to cut down on electronic waste and the environmental impact, I do genuinely wonder how much of a deal it's going to be in 2 years' time when a company comes out and says, do you know what, we've gotten rid of the charger port entirely and we're now just doing wireless charging.
Jess, in terms of the consumer side of things, do we benefit from this?
I think we would benefit to a certain extent, but not massively. I think some people were up in arms initially when the manufacturers stopped shipping devices with plugs. And then everybody, as we mentioned earlier, you know, kind of realized they all have one of those plugs in a drawer somewhere. So they got over it. I don't think we'll lose out. I do think something that would have to be taken into consideration is if you have other accessories that your phone fits into. So, for example, if you have a speaker that your phone plugs into, or if you have, you know, any of those type of accessories that requires a certain type of port, and then if they all move to a different kind of port, that makes your accessories a bit defunct. So in that regard, it's not great. But as I said, I don't think it's going to be a massive issue from the consumer side of things. It's more a consideration for the manufacturers.
And Jess, you're speaking about defunct devices. We can think back with, say, 10, maybe even 15 years. I think everybody still probably has that drawer. Do you have any advice for our listeners what they can do with those drawers full of electronic tech that could be literally decades old, but they don't know what to do with it and they want to do something responsible when recycling?
Yeah, you can. There are outlets that will take cables to either recycle or repurpose them. There are also a number of charities that accept devices, tech devices, to either repurpose them or use the parts in some way, shape or form. We're also seeing companies like Apple and indeed Samsung taking old devices back as part of a trade-in. So Apple last week unveiled the iPhone 13, and you can get money off the iPhone 13 if you trade in an older Apple device. So everybody is more aware about when it comes to reusing and repurposing older devices. What I would say is if you are hanging on to old cables and you have multiples of the old cables, maybe this weekend just spend a bit of time going through, seeing if they all work. Maybe keep two of each cable, one as a backup and one to have. But beyond that, you don't need to hang on to them all. So maybe try and find either a charity that accepts them, or, as I said, you can find an outlet that will recycle them for you.
Tech correspondent Jess Kelly, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that was, of course, Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble. And my thanks to Ciara Noble for today's programme.